Absolutely incredible. This is exciting each week as I have the chance to, for Vader Percussion, to bring to you a different angle of the music industry. And what we're about to experience today is real serious history. What you just heard with these great artists that you have, you're going to hear the musicians that have supported them and have absolutely created an incredible legacy in this crazy music industry, and coming from this special area called Muscle Shoals. This is just beautiful. Our guests today are live from inside the legendary Fame Studio in Muscle Shoals in Alabama. And for those that may not know, Fame is where legendary artists have recorded major hits. I mean, these are artists like, and I have to look at the list here because it's absolutely endless. Etta James, Aretha Franklin, Paul Anka, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, the Osmond Brothers, Duane Allman, Tim McGraw, Dixie Chicks, Alicia Keys, Steven Tyler. I mean, there are countless others at Fame. There's a subject to an incredible documentary, which is available on Amazon Prime. You can go check this out. Just called Muscle Shoals, and sit down and be prepared to be taken onto a journey of the beautiful songs from the river of the area in Muscle Shoals. We want a special thanks to Spencer Coates and Rodney Hall of Fame for giving us access to such an incredible place in history. So let's bring on these incredible artists. I first want to bring on Justin Holder. Justin's musicality, personality, and work ethic has made him one of the go-to session players at the legendary Fame Studios. With a history so rich in iconic musical hits, Justin has to deliver the goods at Fame, which he has been doing consistently. Justin, thank you so much for joining me.
How you doing, Dom? Pleasure to be here with you.
Fantastic. Well, we've got so many things to talk about, and I'm going to bring the other guys on, which is just incredible that this is happening and coming from Fame. This is huge. Let's go on now to this next legendary player, Calvin Holly. Calvin Holly's musical career has been going strong since the 1970s. He was a longtime guitarist for Little Richard and has appeared on numerous albums by Little Richard to Greg Allman, as well as various movie soundtracks. He continues to appear on recording sessions and live gigs around Muscle Shoals. Please welcome Calvin Holly.
Hey, Dom. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us, Vic.
My pleasure.
This is, now you guys, now I know, Justin, you're in what part of the studio are you in?
I'm in the control. I'm in the actual studio of Studio A. Kelvin's in the control room of Studio A here.
Incredible. Well, this next person I want to bring on is another important factor in this here, Will McFarlane. In 1974, Bonnie Raitt came across Will playing at a club in Massachusetts, which led him to touring with her for the following 6 years. Will then moved to Muscle Shoals to get into session work, and it found him recording for Etta James and Levon Helm and Joss Stone, Johnny Taylor, Bonnie Raitt, and a long list of others. He continues to record, play, and teach. Please welcome Will McFarlane. Here it is.
How you doing, Dom? Glad to be here.
Gentlemen, so great to have you here. You know, I got to first go back, and I want to start with Calvin. Calvin, just tell me a little bit of your history of just kind of how you got involved in music and how you got involved in playing guitar.
Well, like most musicians in my age bracket, you know, I would have to say first and foremost was seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. But when I was maybe around 8 or 9 years old, we had a neighbor, and every Sunday he would come out on his porch with a Gretsch Chet Atkins guitar, Gibson amplifier, and a bottle of Jim Beam. And he would play like Chet Atkins, and I was just fixed on it. And he showed me my first lick on the guitar, and ever since then I've been hooked, you know. So been doing it. I immediately knew what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
Kelvin, what do you think about the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show? And myself too. I was 10 years old when that hit, yeah. And it just completely sucked me into wanting to play music. What was it about that band that just grabbed people and just lured them into the music industry?
Well, it was a lot. There were a lot of factors. You know, the fact that they all dressed nice and looked the same, different haircuts. They were singing their own songs. I'd never seen anything like it, you know. And I was just, wow, I've never seen anything like it. Go to school the next day, everybody wants to start a band, you know. And I mean, grow your hair out, whatever, you know. I mean, it changed, everything changed overnight, you know.
Yeah, well, it literally did change overnight. It really was powerful to experience the wave of desire of everyone to want to play music. Will, tell me a little about yourself. You know, where were you born? How did it all kind of come about in your life?
Well, I'm a Navy brat, and so I went to a different school every year of my life. I was born on a Navy base, actually, in Coronado, California, but I think I was there 3 weeks or whatever. And went back to the D.C. area, and as a fighter pilot in the Navy, my dad was stationed around Jacksonville a lot. My mom, who died when I was 5, I never knew this about her, but she had perfect pitch and had studied music at the University of Texas. And so there was this thing in me, even when I was 5 and 6, I wanted to sing in a little kid choir, and I started taking piano lessons at 7. But the same as Kelvin, when I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, I just knew that's what I did. And my dad at that point, who was the left-brained, you know, engineering test pilot, he saw music sort of as the enemy of my education and threatened to take my guitar away from me if I got a B in school. So, you know, I would tell Dad, there's just something in here. You know, I think seeing the Beatles too, before then, it was like Elvis in a backup band, but the Beatles were a band. There was something about the band that really attracted me. I think there were 3 bands in my junior high. I was in 8th grade when I saw them on Ed Sullivan, and I think there were 3 bands in my junior high within a month, you know, after we saw the Beatles. But I went to a different school every year, you know, that kind of thing, until finally finished high school in Long Island, where my dad was a test pilot for Grumman.
Well, that's pretty powerful. You know, and I remember Grumman was a huge facility that, you know, thousands of people worked there. And it was at that Grumman facility that they actually made the lunar module that landed on the moon.
That's right. That time. Yeah.
So that was a pretty serious dedicated area. So what kind of music, were you listening to around that time?
Well, you know, the time I was there in Long Island, you know, we'd already had the British invasion, but it was also, you know, the Mustang Sally, I actually had my high school's girlfriend's name was Sally, and my dad had a 64.5 Mustang, and the first date I ever went on with Sally was in, you know, when I could finally drive, was in a Mustang. So we did Mustang Sally and Knock on Wood, and it was soul music. I actually didn't really have that thing in me that was the Eric Clapton lead guitar player kind of god. I was the rhythm guitar player in all my bands. There was always a lead guitar player, and so I sort of sang and played rhythm. So I was really attracted to the R&B thing. And, you know, it was a funny thought. Billy Joel went to the next high school over at Hicksville High, you know? And we were in a battle of the bands with him, and he had a song out called You Got Me Hummin' that was a local hit, you know, that they did a cover of this R&B tune. So that kind of R&B thing in high school was what I was really attracted to. And so that really drew me into listening to the rhythm guitar players like Cornell Dupree and, you know, Steve Cropper and that kind of thing.
Well, what great music to grow up to at that time. I think we were all pretty much blessed. Justin, I got to go to you now. You're a little bit younger in the crew here. So how did it start for yourself?
Well, my dad was pretty much, Will and my father were like brothers. So I grew up on the road carrying their gear. They were in a band together. And I just grew up around Will. And watching them made me want to be a musician. It made me want to continue that. And I gave up everything 10th grade, told my mom, not going to college. I am going to be a musician somehow or another, and just stuck it out. And here I am still. So, but a lot of it goes to Will. I mean, we'd be riding the road and he would have charts out, and I was 13, 14, and he's teaching me and his oldest son, Jamie, how to read charts. And so we I was a sponge for knowledge with him growing up.
Justin, who were a couple of your drumming influences when you were growing up?
Well, I had a dog for 13 years named Vinny. So Vinny Colaiuta was my idol. I wanted another dog and named him Gad. I wanted Vinny and Gad. And but then as I've gotten older, those were my early on guys. And honestly, a couple local guys that he played in a band with Will and my dad, Mike Caputi. He was in Marty Stewart's band, T. Graham Brown's band. And I watched him and this other guy, Tony Mora, and our local church drummer, John Jackson. These three guys really I was around them more than I was anything else. We didn't have internet. You know, I stumbled upon you at Drummer World, Dom. That's where I found out. It just, Drummer World really opened me up to everybody, you know, and I was even younger. I'd go to the local music store and he'd give me a VHS of a compilation of the DCI videos. So I would go and wear it out and just sit there. I'd take drums apart, put them back together. And drums was my life. That's all I ever wanted to do.
Boy, that is fantastic.
But anyway, I wanted to mention a couple. Steve Jordan now is one of my favorite. There's so many. Simon Phillips. I mean, Jeff Beccaro, you know. Dave Weckl. I learned how to tune drums from Dave Weckl watching those videos.
I know early on you had mentioned Hal Blaine, too. I mean, there were all these different incredible legends that we learned from.
And those are the kind of guys, your Jim Gordons, your Gene Chrismans, your Hal Blaine, your Jim Keltners, that do stuff where you go, why did he do it? Roger Hawkins, perfect example. Why would you do that? Like, what made you think that way and so creative? Some of those Dusty Springfield records with Gene Chrisman on there. I mean, that some of those brilliant little parts I've ever heard in my life, and it's just, it's way outside the box, you know?
Well, it seems like, you know, you guys are at Fame Studios, and this studio is just such a phenomenal, and I think the documentary that is out several years ago really kind of captured the story and the history for future generations to understand. But I got to go back. I'll start, Kelvin, what was it like, you know, just being involved with this studio? What was this? Did you even realize what the hell was going on when you were younger?
Well, no, not really. My first inkling of Fame Studios, as an example, my dad was military as well. And so we moved around a lot, too. But we were living in Smyrna, Tennessee, outside of Nashville. But I picked up, remember the Hit Parader magazine?
Yeah.
Well, I picked it up and there was a little article and there was a picture of Dwayne Allman. I didn't even know who he was, but it had a little article in there about Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals. So that was my first inkling of what it was, you know. And then, of course, later I found out that some of my favorite songs of my lifetime were recorded here, you know. So.
Well, just so you know, Kelvin, you know, a lot of the songs in my lifetime were recorded there and you were on them. So.
Well, I wasn't really on those per se. That was usually, you know, I didn't actually move to Muscle Shoals until 1990.
Interesting,
so,
yeah.
You know, and I never really aspired to be a session guitar player. I just liked to play guitar and play in bands. I was mainly a live player, you know. But once I moved here and I met the Swampers and they started, you know, calling me and asking me to come do sessions and stuff, you know. So I've kind of been doing that ever since, you know.
So you got sucked into it. You got sucked into the Swamp.
Yeah, I did. You know, the first night I met Jimmy Johnson, he said they were getting ready to record Bobby Bland. Would I be interested in come into play? And I said, shoot, yeah, man, I'm there, you know. So, that was the first real session I did here, you know.
What year was that?
That was around probably 91, 92, right, somewhere in there.
How amazing. How absolutely amazing. Yeah. I mean, such great music came out of there. Will, what was it like for you when you finally made the move to come out there? You had been with Bonnie Raitt for several years, and all of a sudden now you decide to come down to Muscle Shoals. What was it about that brought you down there that got you involved with Fame?
Well, actually, I met Jimmy Johnson in a hotel room in L.A. A friend of mine, mutual friends, a guitar player named Duncan Cameron, actually introduced me to a guy who was managing the record label down here. He said, I got a guy you got to meet. So he took me to meet Jimmy Johnson in a hotel room, the Sunset Marquee in L.A. And we sat there and Jimmy said, well, play me something. So I played him a song I'd written and he said, play me something I don't like. And he goes, I'd really like to bring you down to Muscle Shoals. And I was already married with children. I had boy-girl twins in 1977. And so I was on the road with Bonnie, you know, and we're doing 100 whatever, 70 cities a year. And I'm away at 200 days. And you know, we were just, Janet and I looked at each other when they made us the offer and said, we'd love to have you come down here. And Jimmy Johnson's the reason I moved down here. I knew about Muscle Shoals. I was totally hip. We woke up to the Bealtitudes record as a band in 72 and just listened to these guys play. So I was a huge fan of Roger's Pocket. And so I came down here and they just assimilated me into the rhythm section. And I ended up in headphones with them for 20 years, you know. And actually at the time, Fame and Muscle Shoals were a little bit, you know, sort of at odds with each other here and there. And Rick Hall was actually having guitar players sign exclusives that they wouldn't work for anybody else but him at Fame. And I wouldn't do that. But Rick liked me and I liked him and he liked my playing. So about once a year, Rick would bring me over here. There you go. I love that. We became dear friends in our older days. And I totally love that man. And actually, as a quirk of fate, my father died 2 days after Rick Hall. And so Rodney and I have that in common. But Rick would bring me over here and just, you know, drive me crazy, you know, for a 3-hour session. And you know, I love every war story I have with Rick Hall, you know. And eventually now, Fame has been operating so much, I've become one of the primary guys over here. I really appreciate work. I've probably worked at Fame more than any other place in the last course, in the last 10 years. I certainly have. And but my original thing was that Jimmy Johnson brought me in.
So when you first came into Fame, what was it like? Your first session, you walk in, you're going to record. What did that feel like, knowing the history that had gone on before?
Oh, yeah. I thought, well, I just moved to town and Rick apparently turned to Walt Aldridge and said, I need a slide player. Who do we have? And he said, well, this guy just moved here from Bonnie Raitt's band. I'm pretty sure he could play slide. Let's get him over here. And he goes, get him over here. So I brought my 54 Strat and my 59 Basement. I thought, I'm going to go totally vintage on these guys. You know, this place has such history. I'm going to bring my most historical instruments. And I came over here and put a slide solo on a Terry Gibb album for Rick, you know. And the funny thing is, Rick only wanted the opening lick. He didn't want me to play. But so I did it. I did it right the first time, and Rick goes, that isn't it, and he plays it for me again. I went, well, gosh, and I did it again. He made me do that lick because he was going to pay me for a 3-hour session. He just wasn't going to play me for 5 minutes of it. So he made me do that. He made me do that lick basically for about 2.5 hours, you know. Change it up, put it here. And finally at the end he goes, all I want is this. I did it the same way I did it the first time. And he goes, that's what I've been asking you for 3 hours, and walks out of the control room. And I looked at Walt and I went, is this normal? And he goes, man, he had Reggie in here last week and only used 2 licks. So you're right in there with the best in the world. So no, that was my introduction to Fame, was a 3-hour overdub session with Rick Hall.
3-hour tour.
Yeah, for yes. Sure. Justin, as a drummer, you come in there, And you walk into the studio. What was it like in your involvement with coming into Fame?
Will's been the guy that's given me an opportunity through my whole life. And so these two are my dads. I call Kelvin Padre. And but coming in here, my view was the smell. There's something about the smell of this room. It's that years and years of people being in here, and then the tone of the drums in this room. My first session here was with a young girl, and I believe it was me, Will, and David Hood. And I remember coming in from my live background of drumming, I'm going to match the bass player. I'm going to play what he's playing with my kick. So I said, David, what are you playing? And David just went, nuh-uh, don't play to me. You play, I'll play off you. And I went, okay. And that kind of, it taught me something about just keeping that engine going while everybody else works on top of it, as opposed to being so tight-knit with a bass player in his fingers. Like, you know, most drummers are taught, you got to be locked in with the bass player. But that was my first experience here. And then later on, getting to work with Rick a few times. So that was cool, too, for me.
Unbelievable. Kelvin, tell me about Rick Hall. What was it like? I mean, this was a man that had obviously an incredible genius towards music and more than just music. I guess he knew how to produce music that could reach people at a high level to create all of these number one hits.
Yeah, I think I think Rick knew what he had an idea of what he wanted to hear, but if you hit it while he was hearing it, then that was it, you know. I mean, I would sit in here in the control room with him and overdub guitar solos or whatever. And he'd go, oh, I love that. I love that. And then we'd move on to something else. 2 hours later, he'd come back. You know what? I don't love it. And then next thing I know, I'd be redoing it, you know. But he seemed to know what he wanted after he heard it, you know. There would be something about what you played that he went, that's it right there, you know. And then, you know, I remember one day I was in the grocery store and he called me up and he said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm at the store. He said, well, I need a down. And I said, what? He said, I need somebody to come play down on the guitar. And I said, well, I'll be there in like 15 minutes. I think they had a guitar in here or something. I came in and went down. And that was it. That was it, you know. So, but once he gets fixated on a sound or a lick or something, it's like he can't wait. He wants it now, you know. And so I'm sure Will's been in the same spot with him, you know. So,
oh, yeah.
It almost seems like he was like a great grid at putting puzzles together, because he would take,
well, sure,
right, not only individual musicians, yeah, but certain artists, and then parts of the
exactly
tune.
Yeah, he would hear the parts in his head or what he envisioned, and he would like, okay, get this guy or get this guy, you know. And they would gradually make the puzzle, you know. So, but
one time,
yeah, he had some ears.
One time,
so what was it like for you, Will?
Well, one time I remember, it just reminded me of one of Rick's things he would say all the time is, don't do that anymore. I said, and I'd say, well, I thought you told me to. He goes, yeah, I didn't know I didn't like it till I heard it. And so one time I was playing acoustic guitar. It's a very simple acoustic part. I was in my own booth in the back, and we'd already cut 10, 12 passes. It was a floor full of A-team guys, you know. It was all A-team. It was, you know, and we were sure we'd already gotten it, but he kept looking for something. And at one point, I'm sure we're doing it. We're right in the middle of the take. All of a sudden, he comes into my booth, and I realize, well, this ain't the take because Rick's in my booth with me. He pulls a headphone off. He starts whistling into my ear, just you know, and then lets the headphone go from about 6 inches, whop, you know, and walks out of the room, comes back through the talk back and goes, yeah, Will, I was just giving you an idea of the string part I'm hearing in my head. And so, I mean, there are so many stories like that that Rick honestly, and I say this, when he says, I didn't know I didn't like it till I heard it. Rick was one of those guys that would sort of assemble a group of people that he really liked, and he knew they were going to do it, and then he just wanted a bunch of takes. Like at Muscle Shoals Sound, we tended to be a first take band. Like, let's just get our feel, and if there's a problem, it punch in. But Rick tended to be, let's work with this and work with this until I hear what I love. And it was a different way to record. Very, very different. I geared up for Rick in a different way than I geared up for the Muscle Shoals Sound.
You know, the term genius, when it's used, I think, you know, nowadays it's used way too much. You know,
yeah.
But I mean, when you think of someone like Rick Hall, I mean, he really had a certain genius to be able to put together the pieces of this puzzle of the musical sounds, the musicians, the artists, the recording techniques, the room itself. I mean, there were so many factors that were put in the right place. Justin, what was it like for you to come out here and start working with Rick?
Well, Rick was looking, his intern, John Gifford, was, me and him got really close. And this was my way of, I just, any way I could get into the studio. And I heard Rick was doing a project where he was actually playing this little Fender kind of electric mandolin that he had, this vintage thing. And he was actually going to play that, and he needed a drummer. So I told John, I said, John, tell Rick I'll do it for free. Just get me in there. So John goes to Rick and says, hey, my buddy Justin said he'd do it for free. And Rick said, why is he going to do it for free? Is he not good enough to charge me? And that's when I went, wow, what am I getting into? I would talk to David Hood and I'd say, hey, I've got a Rick session. He'd go, okay, now, if he gets mad, if he yells at you, just keep your cool. Like, I'm expecting to go into session and get yelled at. So I was pale as a ghost the first time I went in there. But there was a moment during that where he kept me in this booth, actually right over here, for about 6 hours. He never took a bathroom break. And at one point, I raised my hand, and he goes, "Yes, son." I said, "Mr. Hall, can I go to the bathroom?" He goes, "Well, of course." And as I'm walking out, he goes, "Son, have you heard stories about me?" I said, "Yes, sir, I have." And I just walked out, and that was it. But but there was a moment during that where it was almost in the documentary where Jerry Wexler walked up to Roger and said, "You're a good drummer." And he just said, after that, I became a good drummer. I just felt more confident. At the end of the session, we're sitting around, and Rick just looks around and goes, "That's a good drummer today." And that was it. I just went, "Oh, my gosh. Wow." All that, you know. But I was terrified.
Well, at that point, you know, like Roger had mentioned in the documentary, you arrived. When you got that kind of a blessing from the amount of musicians that Rick knew, and he kind of said that, that really kind of put a stamp of forever onto your playing.
He didn't know my name for about a year, I think. It was drummer. So I'd see him at like Outback, and I'd walk up, "Mr. and Miss Hall, how are you?" "Linda, it's the drummer." But he got my name right on his CD, so I'm happy about that.
There it is, right? Kelvin, tell me a little bit, if you would, about just the history of Fame. I mean, there's the amount of recordings and artists and your musical career. What is it about the legacy and the history of Fame
Well, it's rich. I mean, number one, it's one of the oldest still functioning studios in the world, owned by the same people. It's never closed down. It's and it's homey. It sounds great. I mean, I don't know. Living here, you kind of tend to, because you've been here so many times, you kind of take it for granted sometimes. I just did some sessions in L.A., like at East West, and I mean, some of those rooms are legendary as well, but I was really excited about recording there, and now I know how people feel when they walk in here and go, "Wow." You know.
That's pretty powerful. So what was it, Kelvin, what do you have as far as memories with the Swampers? What was that like? You know, the rhythm section that was dubbed the Swampers. What was that like?
Well, it's like we all grew up with records, right? So anytime you bought a record that you really, you know, were excited about buying, but you would always open up the liner notes to see who played. And more than half the time it would be, you know, David, Roger, Barry, you know, all these guys. And so I definitely, you know, I looked up to him. I said, "Wow, you know, this is great." Not ever knowing that I would end up here and playing on sessions with him or anything like that. Yeah. All that just happened out of fate, you know. But yeah, it's pretty daggum cool, you know, when you think about it. Because I never really aspired to do that or anything like that. It just happened, you know. It just fell out of the sky, so.
So how do you fit? Why do you think fate stepped in? What was it about in your life that you, what was that ingredient that opened this door for you?
Well, it's hard to say. If I had to put it on one person, I'd have to say it was Johnny Sandlin. Johnny was like the house producer at Capricorn Records in Macon, Georgia forever. You know, back in the early 70s, he produced the Allman Brothers, on and on and on, you know. But he had a band, excuse me, and I didn't even know Johnny was from Alabama. I knew who he was. We'd never met, seen his name on a lot of records. But I got a phone call out of the blue one day, and it was him. He said he lived in Decatur, Alabama, which was 20 minutes from where I lived. And he had a band called the Decoys. And got my number from somebody and called me, wanted to know if I'd come over and hang out with him and maybe do some playing. And I did. And I ended up joining the band and ended up playing with him almost 30 years, you know. But Johnny had a studio in Decatur, and he put me to work over there. So I really learned a lot from him, you know. I have to give him credit for that. So.
How amazing. Will, what was it like just for yourself? I mean, the Swampers had a reputation of of what it was about and to step into this world. What was it like for you to be a part of this?
Well, you know, when Jimmy first, you know, met me and said, I want to demo that tune. As a matter of fact, we came down here and demoed it, and he pitched it to McGuinn Hillman, who Wexler was producing, and they cut it. So I thought, wow, I just go to Muscle Shoals, cut my first demo, and it's on a record by somebody I admire. But they flew me down here, and to put a studio band together, they had Roger Hawkins, David Hood, Clayton Ivey, Randy McCormick, Mac McAnally on acoustic, and Duncan Cameron and I were on electric guitar. And I mean, I'm just, and they showed me these little number charts, which I instantly identified with, and said, well, let's run it down, sort of look at this. Okay, doesn't cost any extra to hit a red light. And I just done a couple of Bonnie Raitt records where they'd done, you know, 40 takes of every one and cut the 2-inch tape. And so here I am in Muscle Shoals, and we just say, hit a red light, and we just play it through. And at the end of it, Jimmy Johnson goes, any confessions? And I turn to David Hood and I go, you guys keep first takes around here? He goes, all the time. And I flew back to L.A. and I gave everybody notice. I said, I'm moving to Alabama. And I'd just done some of the urban cowboy sound. I was getting called by guys and doing some real A-team stuff. And whenever they couldn't get maybe James Burton, they knew I had a Telecaster. And, you know, a lot of the L.A. guys were so great, like Larry Carlton and O.J. Graydon and those guys, more 335. You know, I was more a Tele guy. And so I started getting a lot of work. And I said, I'm moving to Alabama. And they all went, you're crazy. You're committing career suicide or whatever. And I said, man, I am moving to the land where they keep first takes. And so I moved down here, and Jimmy started just to use me. He wanted to sit behind the glass more. So in a lot of ways, I became Jimmy Johnson's alter ego, except he wasn't a lead player at all. And so I did all the chinks and all the, you know, all the fourths and all the pretty stuff, but I could take solos too. And he just included me with everything he did in a lot of ways for like 20 years. And when they got inducted in the Musicians Hall of Fame, he just said, well, we couldn't have done it without our friends, and Will's one of them, which is by their great largesse, I must say. But after playing with him for 20 years, he included me in their induction. And all I can say is still every time I was in headphones with Roger Hawkins, it was mystical. His bass drum was a metronome. His hi-hat was unbelievably sensitive, but he dropped his stick on the snare in this place that he said he wasn't even aware of. He didn't realize what he had that did it for people. And I think a lot of my pocket in life is from 20 years of listening to Roger drop his stick about as far back in the pocket as you could get. I heard a great story about him once by Will Lee when they brought him to New York to do something. And Will said he just felt like Roger was dragging through the track. And then he went and listened to the playback and he went, oh, I'm sorry, I'm rushing. It was a very humble interview by Will Lee. And it's the way I feel just being in headphones with these guys every time I was. And Roger used me for his productions when he produced artists. And he just got very, very close. And I considered it, I mean, here's the guy who at 19 years old had the guts on a New York session to go to the end of Chain, Chain, Chain and hit the bell and go, dang, da, 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 dang, gang, gang. I mean, how much brass did that take? I mean,
I interject on this one? I actually got to ask Roger. I talked to him and I said, Roger, third verse of Aretha's Chain of Fools, just halfway through, you go to the bell. What made you do that? And he goes, I was lost. And I went, oh my God, what a great story of just the improv, you know, being able to improvise like that and stay there and own it.
Driving the train.
Boy. He did, man. One time, I was doing a very simple acoustic part with Roger. And about every 16 bars, Roger was just lifting his hi-hat. You know, it was like like that. And then he'd just hold it straight. And about 16 bars later, he went, or whatever. And I started going, or it was actually a tit-tat. And I started going, just a little bit of a shimmer with the acoustic. And as we went in and listened to it, Roger, who didn't give compliments, you know, brazenly, he was very soft-spoken. And at one point, he just turned to me and he goes, you're playing good today. And I went, well, thanks, man. I said, I'm just listening to you. And he goes, well, good players are good listeners. And I've said that to so many young players that it takes you a certain amount of time to learn how to do something that's vaguely interesting. And then it takes you the next amount of time to figure out what of that to leave out. I tell people I get hired for what I leave out. I know what not to do, you know, and that's one of the things I tried to instill in Justin was it's not what you put in. It's how you feel and where you the song is in the holes. Be careful which ones you fill.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, that's absolutely great advice. You talk about Roger Hawkins. This is the book called Sticks and Skins that was put together about all these different drummers and all their different lives. And I'm honored to be in this book, but this is my favorite page.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, that's my favorite page. And it talks about Roger and what he did. So Justin, listen, what was it like? I mean, you had to listen to a lot of these recordings. You knew what Roger's, you know, playing ability was at. He couldn't join us today. You know, we'll have to see if we can organize it at some point in the future. But tell me a little bit about what you had to study to understand Roger. I mean, he's
a lot of it was space. A lot of it, like, and I mentioned this to him recently. I said, you know, I was cutting my grandfather's grass, listening to a live John Hammond record you and David Hood were on. And for about 40 minutes of this live record, I think he may have hit a crash or a ride once. And that just was so, you know, I'm from like the 90s drumming of, I was around here when Shenandoah was big and a lot of the country stuff. And there was like a format I felt like to that type of drumming. But to leave that much space, it was curious to me. So I started like listening more. And there's just subtle things. For instance, when A Man Loves a Woman, leading into all these little big crescendos, he'd press roll it real quick. He was, to me, the king of these dynamic press rolls. And I said that to him, and he goes, I don't call them press rolls. They're dynamics. And it was so cool. And so for me, having to learn that kind of stuff, and we get the chance to play, you know, when a man loves a woman, Respect, Mustang Sally, we get to record those. So I get to put on my Roger Hawkins hat quite often. And it's just really, it's the space and the drive he had with his tempo. And that's something I don't even think I've gotten yet, because there was something so magical about how he played. And I'm still learning. Three nights ago, I was in headphones on Spotify on this Roger Hawkins playlist I found, just zoning out for hours listening to him, you know.
Well, I'm gonna go check that out, man. I want to find out that playlist, man. I want to sit down. I want to steal as many more ideas as I can from Roger as I can musically.
Kodachrome, what a great example there. Yeah. Kodachrome by Paul Simon, the little da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, the little like trot. I asked him. I said, "What was that?" They took a reel-to-reel box, opened it up, and he kept crumbling pieces of paper. And he played it, I think, with the eraser tip of pencils. And that was it. But where does that come from? That genius. And it's, you know, we try to get those little, we'll hear a song and go, man, this has that Kodachrome feel. Let's put something underneath it like Roger did.
Very musical.
Boy, that's absolutely, well, all these different drummers. I mean, Roger is just a legend at what he does. Will, I know you had played with Levon Helm. What was that like?
Well, that was top five in my life. I honestly can tell you that, you know, I adored him. And we got to cut tracks for a guy's record. I sang on his solo record, actually. I didn't get to play guitar on it. I sang on it with him, which I was thrilled to do. And then we cut tracks. And my most fun of that, of course, he hates clicks. He says, you're like Bernard Purdy, who I've gotten to play with as well. He was like, I am the click. And the human being speeds up a little when he's excited, and he pulls it back a little when he wants some drama, and don't worry about it, you know. And he just owned it that day. His tracks were so easy to feel on. And then they sat me down with him, and they wanted Leakage. They wanted him to play mandolin and wanted me to play steel body dobro. And so the two of us just sat there bantering for 2 hours and overdubbed it. And I literally went home that night. Janet said, how was your day? And I said, if I quit now, I could tell people I used to be in the music business. I just spent the day with Levon Helm. And so I got to cut tracks with him, and then we overdubbed. And I remember the first tune, we listened down a little. He goes, I'll tell you what, Will, I'll take the intro, you take the first verse, and after that, it's every man for himself. that's some of my favorite studio advice I've ever gotten. But yeah, Levon again, he's another one like Roger. I put those guys like Keltner, Roger, Levon, they're musicians at the drums. Jim Gordon, yeah. They're musicians. They're coloring, they're orchestrating in a colorful way. They follow the lyric. They're really interesting in where they put their fills and put their roles, and it's not like anybody else. Those three that I've worked with that are the most, interesting. They're like iconoclasts. They're alone in their little Venn diagram of the way they push and pull. And when you watch Levon, I don't think anybody's ever sung and played as well on drums as Levon either. I mean, there's nobody at all that good. But I loved Levon's, the same as Roger. It was actually very comfortable for me being used to Roger to play with Levon.
They all seem to have like a swing when they play. There's just this. It's very so musical. You can just feel it, So,
Kelvin, what do you? So, what do you look for in a drummer, Kelvin? What do you see that?
Well, I look for that. I look for somebody that plays the song and not. I mean, there's a lot of great drummers out there that know all the hot licks and stuff, but there's a handful that have their own identity, Ringo was that way. The way he would do his roles, I know him being left-handed had a lot to do with that. But Roger, what he plays on I'll Take You There, by the Staples Singers. I mean, it's just brilliant, They stand out just like the rest of the good, like the lead instrument on the song. They stand out, So
I was gonna,
that's what I enjoy. Justin has that same thing when he plays. He gets musical like that. He gets real creative, and it's not so much, how much you play or how much you know. It's how you feel it. So
I just wanted to interject too that Roger always liked people to know that on I'll Take You There, there were only three mics on the drums. He had a kick drum and two overheads. He kept adjusting the overhead to get it where he liked it. All the dynamics on that song, the cack, cack, where he'd drop it back down. There were three mics on the drums. And now when you sometimes see a drum set up with, where it takes half the board, Roger got what he got. He got what he got dynamically in three microphones.
Incredible. Incredible. My drum set back here has 10 mics on it. When I record and do my thing, everything is mic'd. It's incredible how close mic'd everything is. So to hear that just goes to show the real creativity. And listen, that's a natural skill that Roger has, that all of you have musically on your instrument. Kelvin, what was it like, being a session player? You're walking into a session, you have no idea what you're going to get to a large part. You walk in and you've got to be an open book and a blank slate.
Go ahead.
What was that like for you, and how you had to adapt to that?
Well, of course, every session's different, but it's like Will said earlier, you just kind of come in, you get the chart, you hear the demo, and the next thing you're playing in the band, and you're playing what you feel, and a lot of times it comes out right. We might end up doing a few overdubs here and there, but that's pretty much it, play what you feel, unless the artist or the producer has a certain lick or whatever. But very rarely we just come in and knock them out. I mean, we just did, we had T. Graham Brown in here for 2 days. We did 13 songs in 2 days. And most of the takes were first or second takes, you know. We just sat down and played them, you know. So I'd look at Will and go, well, where are you gonna be on the neck? And I'll be down here. And but it was cool, you know. Knock out 13, it's like old school, you know. Do a whole album in 2 days, you know. So
yeah, we were all on that record.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, that is serious old school, you know. And as a matter of fact, it's not even old school, it's old school.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do too with the fact that, I mean, we all know each other. We know how we play in bands together. So we kind of have an inept, you know, we know what we're going to do, you know, so, and we just come in here and do it. So,
this got to be a real,
very organic, I guess is the word I'm looking for. So,
it's got to be, you got to be flexible and adaptable immediately.
Yeah. You come in here, you listen back and you go, well, I need to fix that or I need to change my part right there. But that's basically it, you know, so. Mm.
I was going to say that cutting tracks is a conversation. And the point of being a session guy is that you have enough under the hood, you know, enough in your reservoir that if they change the subject, you know a little bit about that subject too. I don't think any of the three of us are like the greatest, you know, a super specialist, but we're jack of all trades. We know a lot about a lot of different stuff. And so if the session seems to be going in that direction, because we might come in one day and cut Gut Bucket Country, but we all love Gut Bucket Country. I love Roy Nichols. Kelvin and I went to different schools together on country. You know what I mean? Or you might come in the next day and cut a Gut Bucket rhythm and blues track, and the next day blues, the next day rock and roll or pop. And you need to have enough under the hood to have the conversation when all of a sudden the drummer does that or the keyboard player does something, you go, oh, are we going there? And you adjust on the fly. You're not just thinking about what you know that you can play on this track. You're listening to the conversation and responding in kind.
Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting when you think about just that level of adaption and that level of, you know, spontaneity that has to happen in the now, in the moment. There's no other time than in that moment at that time, which is a very, very powerful tool once someone understands how to do it. Yes, Justin.
One thing I learned about being here in the studio too was being decisive, being a quick, this is it. Because before, every drummer could sit there and hear a track and go, oh, I could do it this way. Oh, I could try this. Oh, what if I did this? What if I did that? But it's that initial gut feeling and you go with it. And it took me a long time to get there because I was so indecisive just personally. Everybody else were cutting the tracks, but I'd leave going, I don't know. And then now it's more of a, where's your gut tell you? Follow that and go from there. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
Well, that's really the power of trusting your instinct for sure. So what is it like? I mean, you know, at those times, it was recording to tape. And when you recorded to tape, listen, you had to play this thing straight through. Now, with Pro Tools and editing and quantizing, there's a whole another world out there. What do you guys prefer? What was it like recording to tape years ago?
Well, my first experience on big-time experience on a Bonnie Raitt record was that they were this was in the 70s, and all these producers were making you take 30 takes of everything and then cutting the 2-inch tape. But the initial, you know, that was crazy. You couldn't even keep time if you were watching the reels go because there were so many edits in the tape. But coming down here, the one thing I loved about cutting the tape was you had this sense, let's get it right. It's not like, I got it right on the first chorus. You can fly that into the second chorus. You can fly that in. You know, it was, let's feel it. There are different dynamics. I don't want to just get one chorus and that's the first chorus and the third chorus. By the time I'm at the third chorus, I might be feeling a little different in this song. I might have heard some different lyrics. And so cutting the tape in a way, you need to be at a level where you get things right the first time a lot more. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Whereas now, but actually a funny thing happened. I cut the tape recently and I go, oh, man, let me punch in there. And it goes, woo, woo, woo. And I realized I'm so impatient. I'm so used to a guy just going right to the spot on tape. And I have to wait for the, you know, the rewind. And it was actually, I realized I've gotten impatient getting used to Pro Tools.
You know, Justin, we talk about and Will had mentioned about having old gear or modern gear. I mean, what do you do as far as drums? Do you have like, you know, vintage stuff and from vintage to modern? How do you adjust what gear you want to use?
Yeah,
I usually come in here and we'll start. I have a Yamaha Absolute Maple kit. I have a 69 Ludwig kit. We have another, I think, 70s Ludwig kit, and there's an older 9. And most of them are mine, and I just leave them here. And then we have a bunch of cymbals, and I'll lay them across the back. Am I good?
You kind of break in and out here.
I'll lay them. Oh, my bad. Well, I'll lay all my cymbals out. I pretty much just lay as much as I can out, hear a track, and walk out the room and find what I feel works.
Interesting.
I just leave stuff everywhere, and I'll put different kits together. And
we have with Kelvin. What about yourself? Do you have older gear or newer gear that you prefer?
Yeah, I'm old school, man. I use, you know, old Fender amps, or lately I've been endorsing Magnetone amplifiers. They're really, really nice. I enjoy that. But yeah, I use older gear. You know, I use anything that works. I'm not one of these guys that has to customize his guitar and try out different pickups. I mean, I buy a guitar, if it sounds great, I don't mess with it. You know, well, let me, you know, so, but yeah, I use older stuff. Pretty much.
Boy, there's something about that old school mentality and desire to play music, for sure, the way I grew up. We played music because it was just fun to play. We didn't get too much involved in anything more than just making it feel good.
I don't think, you know, constantly changing out your pickups, or if I use these drumsticks, it's not really going to make you a better player, you know. I mean, maybe in some instances it does and some it doesn't. I don't know. But if it, you know, when I buy something, I want it to work right off the bat, you know. So.
Well, that's interesting. Justin, I know you play the 55A Vader, which you kind of really kind of feel that that's a comfortable stick for you. What makes that stick feel so good for you?
Sorry, that picture makes me laugh. It's that cross between a 5B, you know, and a 5A, because I love the weight sometimes of a 5B. But also when these guys make me play something like Jessica by the Allman Brothers for like 8 minutes, you know, a 5B is hard to get a 16th note, keeping it going on your ride for a while. So I found the 50, talking with Chad over at Vader. Thanks, Chad, for all you do, by the way. But talking to him, he said, why don't you try these sticks? And I tried it, and they're almost an extended 5A. So it gives me a little bit more balance back here, as opposed to, I'm looking for a little more back here in the butt end of it than I am more at the tip. So something about those, it just all felt right. Every situation, I can flip them over. If I really want something really fat and direct, I'll use the butt end. And it's a good fat butt to hit with, and it's just a great stick all around.
Boy, whether it's drumsticks or guitars or guitar strings, it's amazing how we get so personalized with our gear, and that it truly becomes an extension of who we are.
Yep.
I think that's something that's pretty powerful.
Definitely.
In closing statements, I'm going to ask for some closing statements. Justin, give me a closing statement of what advice you'd give. We've got people that are listening to this from all around the world, Ecuador, all throughout Europe, in South America, in the U.S., Canada. It's pretty amazing of people that are viewing this now. What would you say to that next generation?
Look for the space There's something beautiful in space. There's something beautiful in leaving room for others. And I'm not saying, you know, we're in a world of gospel chops, and I love them. Believe me, I love them. But sometimes it's too much, and you got to know when it's too much and when it's not too much, and learning to hear that space is hard to do because we want the busy. We want the excitement. We want that we've been working on, you know. I remember being a kid and working on a lick and then all of a sudden wanting to show it off to all my friends, but that's not what music's about. And so it's about working together with other people and finding the harmony and knowing that, oh, well, they're going to layer all these other parts. Well, let me leave space for it. So for the final product. So space is really what I would encourage young drummers to look for.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Will, what would you say to this next generation?
Well, it's the same thing. I say, you know, love all sorts of stuff, you know, listen to different kinds of stuff. Let your versatility encourage you. I mean, I love the fact that I get to play on so many different kinds of music, you know, and to do that, you have to understand the music too. It isn't just learning the licks. It's there's a philosophy. There's an overview. There's a history. It would be like if you said, I'm a world-class historian on American history, but you came in at the World War I and you had never heard of the Civil War or never heard of the Revolutionary War. You may know every fact from World War I on, but you'd be missing a history. And there's knowledge, there's feel in history, and what they all learned to do was be in the band, be in the song. It takes you a certain amount of time to learn a certain amount of information. And then it takes you, as I said, the next several amount of time to learn what to leave out.
Fantastic, Will. Thank you so much. Kelvin, what would you say? You know, you've got this incredible experience and you are still going stronger than ever. So what would you say to this, to all these people that are listening in some closing comments?
Well, I would just say, first of all, you have to have a passion for it. It really has to be part of your DNA. And basically, you just you follow the muse. You know, one day you're down, you don't know what you're going to do. I mean, this is not an easy way to make a living. If that's what you're trying to do, you know, it's going to be up and down all throughout your career, you know. But you just follow the muse and play with as many people as you can play with. Take advantage of every situation, because most of the time you're going to learn something, you know, even if it's not what to do, you know. So, but the best education is get in the back of a van with a band and play every shithole across the country and, you know, whatever. So, I mean, that's how you learn, you know.
Like Nike says, just do it.
Just get out there and do it, man. Just get out there and do it, you know.
One last thought. Justin, name one artist on a bucket list that's alive or not that you would have loved to have played with.
John Mayer.
John Mayer, good for you.
Without a doubt, John Mayer.
Fantastic. Will, who would you say?
Well, believe it or not, I would have loved to just trade dates with Eric Clapton.
Fantastic. Kelvin, who would you say?
Well, that's a long bucket list for me, but yeah, Clapton, that would be a good one for me too, because I mean, of course, in our age bracket, we learned back in the 60s. I didn't know who a lot of these blues guys were if it wasn't for the Brits bringing it back. But that John Mayall Blues Breaker album was what really caught my attention the first time I heard it, you know. So,
absolutely.
But yeah, I'd have to say probably Clapton, you know.
Clapton is king for sure. That's no doubt about that, man. Well, you guys, what a pleasure to have some time with you guys. You know, we could always use more time. This, you know, would probably need a part two to continue on, just to be able to have this level of legacy that you guys have been a part of and that you're continuing to be a part of. So I want to thank everybody. Justin Holder, thank you so much. Kelvin Holly, thank you so much. Will McFarlane, thank you so much, guys, for your time, for your effort, and coming to me from Fame Studios. watch the actual documentary on Amazon Prime or even on YouTube, Muscle Shows. I ask everyone to go check it out. Sit back and put your feet up and be prepared to be musically lifted and enhanced from what these great musicians continue to give
us. Hey, Dom.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Yes.
Thank you for all that you do. I sit at home and I've watched you interview everybody under the sun. You're an inspiration to us all. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much, guys. Please stay strong, stay healthy, and I hope someday I get a chance to meet you all in person. That would be fantastic.
Yes.
Awesome.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for your time. Fantastic. Boy, it is so great just to be able to touch base into a little bit of music history like this here. Muscle Shoals, go watch the documentary because it really is something which is extremely important to understand that there's a history that came out of Muscle Shoals, the area where it was, and the fact that the river sang a song that obviously brought all these musicians together from the Rolling Stones to you name it, Bob Dylan. Unbelievable, the artists that were there. So enjoy that for sure. I thank you so much on behalf of Vader. Thanks so much for the opportunity. Chad Brandolini, who's my right-hand man who helps make all this happen. Stay well, and I'll see you next Tuesday, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. We'll do it again, and we'll bring you some more fun. Thanks so much, guys.